The number of children who were intoxicated in utero is frightening, but what is really frightening are the stories told by those who care for them. And so we ask, is there hope for children who are intoxicated in utero?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1215th edition of the Food Chain Radio program. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way up there in Aberdeen who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, we've chronicled the impact to children, their parents, and society at large of children with autism spectrum disorder. What makes the story of those children so sad is that nobody knows why the children have autism, nor why the spectrum appears to be running wild throughout the population. It is a mystery. But there is another spectrum disorder by which children suffer, and there is no mystery as to why they suffer. It is a spectrum of disorders that children suffer from when they were intoxicated in utero as a consequence of a mother who consumed alcohol, drugs, or tobacco, or perhaps all three. This spectrum of disorders includes fetal alcohol syndrome, which can cause physical distortions of the child's face and the cognitive deficiencies of their brains. On the other end of the spectrum are those who suffer from fetal alcohol effects, which can leave children with the same deficiencies as the syndrome, only less so. There are syndromes and effects for any number of the intoxicants that mothers fall prey to, from tobacco to meth to heroin, and there are a lot of pregnant mothers intoxicated. According to a study titled Substance Use During Pregnancy, published in the Harm Reduction Journal, 3.4% of all pregnant women admit to using illicit drugs, and 3.4% admit to binge alcohol abuse. Combined, that's over 268,000 binge drinking, drug taking women carrying babies intoxicated in utero. But if those numbers are sad, the real sadness can be heard in the stories of those who care for the children when they come into the world. And so today we pause to ask, is there hope for the children who were intoxicated in utero? Here to help us navigate these very troubled waters, we have two who navigate the waters every day of their professional life, Alexis Olson and Austin Olson. If it seems as though there are a lot of Olsons on the air today, it's because Alexis and Austin are my kin, and whenever the clan gathers, I hear many of their stories and am grateful they dared to join us on the air today to tell some of those stories. And so, ladies first, Alexis, welcome to the Food Chain Radio Show.
Thank you for having me.
So, Alexis, please describe your career in counseling troubled women. What is your official job title?
My official job title is a mental health counselor.
Mental health counselor, and you specialize in children, correct?
I do, yes. I work at a residential treatment center that houses up to 16 adolescents, ages 13 to 17. We have boys and girls both on the unit at any given time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I happen to know, being a parent, that once a child hits 13, pretty much it's all over by then. There's something about 13, away they go. So you're dealing with children who are in an especially troubled age and also especially troubled for other reasons then, correct?
Correct.
Okay, good. What do you see, Alexis, happening to the children who were intoxicated in utero?
Oh, it's tough, and I'll add that I've worked there for 18 years now, and so, and to this day, anytime I hear, you know, because we get a wide variety of kiddos referred to us for treatment, and some do come in with the actual diagnosis of some, you know, somewhere on the spectrum with mm-hmm. fetal alcohol syndrome, and I can tell you that anytime I hear, like, that I get the clinical information and hear that there's a kiddo that's diagnosed FAS, my heart always sinks, because my experience has been over the last 18 years, it's, it's very limited as far as what we can do for them. They do, typically, I will just kind of summarize, do well, usually in our program, because it is very structured. They don't have to do a lot of thinking for themselves necessarily. You're waking up at the same time, eating breakfast. Consequences are very black and white. So they do pretty well overall in our center, but it's outside of, you know, care, the structured residential treatment setting, that mm-hmm. they really run into a lot of issues. And so it honestly, it varies. It's just a wide range. So
what you see is a lot of everything then.
Yes, a lot of everything. The biggest thing, just if I were just to summarize it, just initially, it's evident. The cognitive delays are evident. You have a child who really struggles to understand even very basic concepts, lack of processing, and it kind of, you know, it impacts typically every aspect of their life, education, socially, family relationships suffer. So it's extremely heartbreaking and detrimental just as a whole.
Okay. Austin, welcome to the food chain.
Hey, thank you. Thank you.
Now, please describe your job description. What is it?
All right. Well, I am a clinical program manager. So I've been in the field for about 20 years, and I've been in every aspect of it. I've been a social worker. I've been a counselor. And now I moved into management administration and currently running a program that provides in-home services to families struggling, and we're trying to really prevent out-of-home placements, youth needing to leave the home to go out of state for residential treatment, and just kind of help families slow things down, get organized, and figure out how to ideally work ourselves out of a job and, you know, teach families how to get on top of things, seek the help they need, surround themselves with the help they need, and function appropriately in life.
Mm-hmm. And what do you see when you see a child who was intoxicated in utero?
You know, I've seen a lot, and I've seen too much. It's the worst day I've ever had in this job, and there's unfortunately a lot of bad ones. I was working as a social worker and had a baby born. We knew the mom was heavily using meth throughout her pregnancy and even up to the end, and we'd been working with the hospital. I was in touch with their social workers. The mom had already had other children removed, had admitted that she's not capable of taking care of her children. She bailed. She left the hospital. We couldn't get her in time. And the other end of all this is withdrawals. That baby died about 3 to 4 days later. We couldn't do anything. So not only do you have these lifelong impacts, and we absolutely see that, it's a lifelong problem. We also are having babies going through withdrawals when they're born, and if moms are afraid to admit it or if they won't admit it, it's we have huge problems. Withdrawals can be deadly. That's opiates, that's methamphetamine. So it's a huge issue, and it's impacting every system we have, schools, everything.
Well, look, I have a tough question for the both of you before we proceed down this road. The two of you are married with a beautiful family of four children. So how do you manage to work in such a chaotic environment and then go home to be loving parents? How do you do that?
Well, I can go first. I honestly feel like working in that environment motivates me to be a better parent, to be the best mother that I can be, because it, again, breaks my heart every day that I go to work, you know, and work with some of these kiddos. And I don't want my kids to ever be exposed to anything even remotely close to that. So for me, it absolutely just motivates me to not ever put my own children in those kinds of situations. So, because a lot of the kids, too, that are FAS or parents are doing drugs, the majority of them end up in foster care. They might be adopted. And so you see a lot of that as well, which is heartbreaking. I've had, you know, clients who have been in the foster care system for years upon years. So just it motivates me to do my best as a parent.
Austin, how do you go home?
Yeah, you know, I'd echo a lot of those sentiments. For me, it's one of the huge whys of what I'm doing and how I'm doing this and, you know, trying to be effective is understanding that this helping anybody is helping everybody. It's these youth are, they're going to the same schools as our children. This isn't isolated geographically. It's everywhere. And so the more I can help these youth, maybe the less negative impact there is in the classroom that my child's in. Maybe my child can get a better education because less time, money, and resources are being spent on this 5 to 10% of the population that has been impacted, doesn't have impulse control. So it's just understanding that we're not only helping individuals and families, we're helping the entire community. We're doing this, it's our way of protecting our family, of making our community, our state better. And that's how we do it.
Yeah, but don't you want to just go home and yell and scream sometime? I can't stand this.
A lot, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, well, let's start in on this now. To what extent do children who were intoxicated in utero populate your industry of care? Is there any way of knowing? Can you see it, or can you discern one thing from another? Alexis?
Yeah, you can. Like I said, some kiddos specifically come in with the diagnosis, the FAS diagnosis, but I would say it's a very small number. It's hard to diagnose. You know, you have to have a parent who is admitting, you have to have, or if not, then somebody who can verify that the parent was consuming alcohol, if all the other, you know, qualifying criteria aren't present. And so I would say, like, the ones that we know officially, the number's pretty, I would say, you know, 25% or less. There are so many more, however, that we suspect have some sort of FAS or effects from parental drug use in utero. So it's
25%?
Yeah, that it's
huge.
Also, yeah. So, yeah, I mean,
so Austin, can you discern the difference between FAS, fetal alcohol syndrome, or is there a difference between FAS and the other syndromes, or meth syndrome, for example?
There is. It's how the toxins are interacting with brain development and everything. It's we're learning through the research that it's much more specific than we previously thought. But on that same note, it's Russian roulette. One kid could be just fine. Another kid exposed in utero to the exact same things could be greatly impacted with the birth defects. And there are certain features that can appear, but you can also be highly impacted and show no physical features. And so that's one of the tough things is mental health diagnosing is not, it's not an exact science. You break your arm or you have a disease, you can go to the doctor and they can tell you exactly this is what's wrong with you. We can't do that in the mental health field. We just have guesses and educated guesses at that, but there is no perfect way to tell. And like Alexis was saying, there's the known that we can have specific treatments for, but it seems like there's a much higher unknown population due to, you know, parents being afraid to admit it.
Wow. So it is Russian roulette. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Hitting What. Today we're talking about mothers who consume drugs and alcohol while they're pregnant and what happens to the children. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. We will be right back. Stay tuned.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, one of the things that occurred to me in listening to you so far is that what percentage of the problem children that you run across are the result of broken families or broken homes, Alexis?
Honestly, the majority. So, yeah, I would say extremely large. And that was actually one of the first things within the first few years that I worked there. That was the main theme that emerged on all clients, not even necessarily ones who were exposed to alcohol in utero. But, yeah, broken homes is unfortunately huge. And like I mentioned before, many of my clients are in foster care, so they're in the system of social services. Many are adopted, and a lot of them, I've seen this far too many times. You know, so you may have a parent who's abusing drugs and alcohol, has a baby, the parental rights are terminated for various reasons. So the child ends up getting adopted to a loving, unsuspecting family. They don't know the history. They don't know mom was drinking while she was pregnant. And then when there may be developmental delays initially, but we know as the children grow and become older and hit those adolescent years, they become even more prevalent, more problematic at times. And then maybe the FAS diagnosis may emerge at that point, and then they're like, oh, no, what did I do? I no longer even want this child because they're too much to manage. Right. And so I've seen too many times, like, failed adoptions, parents who just pretty much want to drop their kids off at my center and kind of wash their hands of them and walk away because it is the behavior issues are too much, the cognitive deficits are too much. And it's heartbreaking. So
that's what you're saying is that the FAS, the syndrome, can be mild to start with, but it accelerates as they age. Did I hear you say that right?
Yeah, well, not necessarily accelerates, but I feel like, you know, when it's a baby, it's not going to be as noticeable. They're sure maybe underweight. There may be certain, you know, developmental delays or milestones that they don't reach, but yes, once they come, usually what I see when they hit about 13 years old, then they might start getting in trouble, breaking the law. So I just kind of mean like the behavioral issues may escalate or get progressively worse at that point. And so, because I see a lot of kids who end up even adjudicated, they're robbing people, they're stealing things, they're breaking the law. So that's kind of what I mean. It's getting, they're becoming increasingly aggressive, maybe even hitting family members in the home, things like that. And so it gets to a point where it's, you know, oftentimes just difficult to manage once the child is older. Because it's you know, easier to manage a temper tantrum of a 5-year-old, right, than a 15-year-old boy. Yeah.
Yeah. So. One would think so. Holy smokes. Yeah. Austin, you do a lot of research. Has there been any research on the impact of broken homes and childhood misbehaving?
Absolutely. And so you even just go back to the most basics in the research. What does the research tell us about substance abuse? And the research is just overwhelmingly telling us that substance abuse leads to lower employment outcomes, higher rates of criminal justice involvement, and violence, and substantial medical and physical issues and consequences. Right there, that is a formula for a broken home. So you kind of end up with a chicken and egg scenario. And then to make things even worse, if a mother is making the choice to use drugs, alcohol, while she has a child growing in her, that behavior usually doesn't stop when the child's born. And then we have a whole bunch of attachment issues. Reactive attachment is one of the most prevalent. And
wait a minute. What is reactive attachment?
Okay, yeah, reactive attachment disorder. So when a child is born, they have 2 to 3 years to learn how to trust, to learn how to love, to learn how to make these healthy, trusting attachments to the adults in their life. And that's it. You can't rewire the brain after that, and the research is devastating. So that's one of the other devastating things is when a parent is struggling with addiction, they are not meeting the needs of their child. And so we end up with this reactive attachment. And we are seeing youth with this that literally do not have the capacity to feel love, to feel remorse, to feel these connections with their fellow human beings. And that's where things can really get dangerous. So between the chemical impact, the brain being rewired and damaged, and then the nurture impact, it's a double-edged sword. It's devastating.
Well, is there a defined line between drinking too much or using too many drugs or too little? I mean, is there a line where you go over the line and it's over? Has anybody ever measured that?
Yes, and that's actually been studied pretty it's been studied extensively, but the results have not been consistent. So that's a frustrating thing. So it varies by expert. The safest thing is just 100% abstinence is the only surefire thing. And that goes back to the Russian roulette scenario. Because in some ways, if you were binge drinking, you're adding a bullet every time you play the game. And your odds, you're going to run out. You're not going to make it. It's not going to end up okay. And so, you know, that's probably the most frightening aspect of that.
Mm-hmm. You know, I once did a television show when I worked with NBC about B.T. Collins and the California Conservation Corps. And B.T. was challenged by Governor Jerry Brown to rein in these kids that were running amok one step away from jail, and they put him in the California Conservation Corps. And B.T. Collins took over this California Conservation Corps, and he was a Marine colonel. So he whipped some Marine order, law and order on the kids, you know, gave them exactly the boundaries that they needed. And he said, those who can't live within these bounds are gone. We're going to throw you out. But those who can stay and be part of us. And he fired 10% of the kids, sent them on their way. But the 90% that stayed within those strict bounds, those strict confines, loved this man. We followed B.T. Collins around for a month, for a couple weeks, all throughout California. And these kids would come pouring out of these camps, big smiles on their face, because they made it. It seems like Alexis was saying pretty much the same thing with what she says. As long as the kids have this incredible structure, they're doing fine. So what happens when there's no structure, Austin?
And that's an incredibly important point, because there's at the instinctual level, and youth know this and we've seen it, if the adults and the authority in their lives aren't strong enough to stand up to them, they're not strong enough to stand up for them. And that structure is craved. And it's been heartbreaking and residential to work with youth that will come back devastated and crying, and we're trying to figure out why. Was the parent mean? And sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes it's the youth will tell us, no, I ran away, I went and, you know, did drugs or whatever their habit is, and my parent didn't say a darn thing. They're devastated from it. So, yes, we all need structure and consistency and accountability in our life, and especially these youth, because their executive functioning, their decision-making process is not working as well as ours. So even when they're trying, even when they're motivated to do well, they're doing it with their hands tied behind their back. If they don't have folks in their life strong enough to care, to believe in them, to want to, sometimes in this field we get so worried about hurting someone's feelings, we're not helping them, because step one in fixing anything is identifying that it's a problem. And that's kind of really where this comes into play is, yes, we absolutely need to care and believe in everyone we work with to know that they can do this. And step one is that accountability, that structure, take that pressure off of them and let them just start to thrive in other areas.
One of the statistics that I ran across that just really stumped me was that 3.4% of the women admitted to taking hard drugs while they were pregnant, and 3.4% admitted to binge drinking when they were pregnant. And I got to thinking, that's a big admission. Alexis, have you met these women?
You know, I can tell you in the last 5 years, I have only had one mother admit that to me, that she was drinking wine almost daily when she would get off of work with her girlfriends. And then she looked at me and said, is that bad? So I still to this day don't know if she was being genuine when she asked me if it was bad that she was drinking wine nearly every single day while she was pregnant. But yeah, no, I haven't. And I've had a few others admit to doing drugs while they were pregnant. Recently I had one admit that she was doing meth, But no, oftentimes they don't admit it. And I will tell you the other piece to that is oftentimes the biological parent isn't even there to give me that answer. It's typically a social worker, an adoptive parent, maybe a grandparent, an aunt, or an uncle. So a lot of times, yeah, I don't even get to see that biological parent.
Tough one. What yeah. do we do with mothers who become intoxicated when they're pregnant? I mean, should we punish them, or should we treat them, or can you do anything with them? Alexis?
Yeah, that is a tough one, and I can tell you my stance on that, just with my training, would have to be treat them. I get the other side. If somebody wanted to argue for punishment, I get that. And honestly, I can't argue against that too much, but I can tell you from my perspective, I am definitely an advocate for treating them, because I know that they're afraid to come forward. And I know that they're afraid if they admit it that, if they have custody of their child, there's a chance that their child could be taken away. But I am just an advocate for, like, let's be honest. Tell us the truth. Tell us if you've been drinking. That way we can correctly diagnose your child and give them the services that they need, that we can help them. So I just don't know that punishing a mother who's drinking while she's pregnant would help the child at all. I think if we could push more treatment options, if any mother who is pregnant, any woman who is pregnant, if there was an open door to a treatment center for them to check themselves in and receive treatment, go through rehabilitation, I am an advocate for that, because this is, we know, 100% preventable. And so I would have to go with the treatment and prevention side over punishment.
Austin?
I take a little bit more of a hard line on that. I totally agree, and I see where Alexis is coming from. But I think it's case by case. The way I look at it is, if a baby's born, that parent is driving, and they're intoxicated while driving. We absolutely apply extra punishment because they're driving intoxicated with the baby in the car. What is the difference between that and making the decision to use substances while that baby's growing inside of you? However, that has to be balanced out with, who do we task with applying this punishment? How do we filter out? What do we do about those mothers that didn't know they were pregnant, genuinely didn't know, and were going about their life, drinking recreationally or maybe even heavy? And so it's, in theory, I absolutely agree with it, but in practice, I think it needs to be all the above. Case by case, absolutely. It's never going to be black and white. We can educate doctors. Some states are doing a really good job with that as far as encouraging doctors in prenatal visits to ask the tough questions, to screen, not just, certain people that meet a criteria, but the folks, we're dealing with addiction. It's just addicts happen to get pregnant sometimes. And so it's the same approach to bigger picture to addiction. And so we need doctors asking questions. We do need parents to feel safe to admitting that they're using these substances. But like I said, when I've been impacted by the fact that I've seen a 3 to 4 day-old baby die because of withdrawals. And so that makes me take a bit of a harder line. But these are questions that we'd have to have a society we could trust, and society would have to figure out how to just deal with addicts and everything to begin with, and there's no answers. It's a mess.
What about the mothers that habitually use and have babies that they just dump on society?
That's where I lose my patience. The answers go pretty slippery slope very quickly, and things can go bad pretty quickly, but this is not an okay situation, because that is much more common than a lot of folks want to admit. A lot of times we don't just see one kid impacted, it's every single kid that's coming out, and at that point I've lost my patience for the soft hand, it is time for consequence. It is time to get things figured out, because these are decisions. It's not just impacting this mother. It's impacting a child for the rest of its life. We're spending, on average, $2 million per youth born impacted by drugs or alcohol in the womb. And that's the impact on schools, the impact on social services. And I've seen the cost much higher, but the Russian roulette thing, sometimes we don't have to spend anything. So the $2 million is that you know, dead median average.
$2 million per child?
Absolutely. Correct. And so going back to what Alexa said about the treatment, yes, some people say that treatment's expensive, but much cheaper than the $2 million we're spending anyways.
Ooh, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What? And what is eating what this evening? We're talking about mothers who consume drugs and alcohol while they're pregnant, thus submitting the child in their uterus to intoxication. And when we get back, I'd like to talk with the two of you about how this being intoxicated in utero becomes manifest in the children. We'll be right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
What you have to say is really sad indeed, and how you go about, you've both been in this for 2 decades or so. How do you manage yourself? How do you hold yourself together when you see and live in all of this pathos, the sadness? Alexis?
I think it's just important to, keep the right perspective. Self-care is huge. So for me, I make it a point to exercise regularly, because that's my therapy. Meditation is helpful. And it's, again, keeping things in perspective that this work is needed. Somebody needs to do it. I've always enjoyed helping others. It's important to, have those professional boundaries as well and keep yourself healthy. And the self-care is huge.
Well, I'd like to go through some of the ways in which being intoxicated in utero has an impact on the children. Let's talk about cognition.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to see things and make sense of them. How does being intoxicated in utero have an impact on cognition?
Yeah, it has a profound impact on cognition. I would say, just in general, deterioration just of general intellectual functioning is probably one of the most devastating effects. And that's something that the kids aren't going to get back. It's not, at this point anyways, it's not something that I have seen, the ability to rehabilitate. It's just, it's gone. It's essentially, they have brain damage. The mother consuming alcohol in utero damaged their brains permanently. So you definitely see cognitive delays. They're also really, really good at pretending to understand. They are masters at just shaking their head, smiling, agreeing, and you really genuinely believe, okay, they get it. But you see through time, no, they really are not getting it. If they have a hard time learning, they have a hard time understanding things, there's language delays. So definitely, like I said, the processing, they have a hard time processing information. You have to keep things very basic and very simple. And, again, it does not improve over time.
Well, Austin, that being the case, what happens when these children matriculate into adulthood?
Well, unfortunately, it's not working out well. So we go back to the impacts that people suffering with substance abuse face, but the higher unemployment, the relationship issues, the criminal justice involvement, that's what happens. And as the person gets older, they are more susceptible to, we work with youth, and a lot of times there's second, third, fourth, fifth chances, and there should be. But sometimes the moment you turn 18, you're in jail, you're in and out of the prison system, and I would imagine, the research is there, but once again, we only know who admitted it, the jails are also full of an astonishingly high number of people impacted by the FAS or on the spectrum. And what we also know is youth that were exposed to drugs, alcohol, in utero are much more likely to begin using and to develop substance abuse issues themselves. And so it turns into a nasty cycle, because some of these folks are going to have kids. Some of these folks are going to use substances while they're carrying, and there's a developing baby inside of them. And so it ends up being a nasty cycle. And right now, the unfortunate truth is we don't have a solid answer. We don't have a, if we do this, everything's fixed. All we can do is just find ways to make things a little bit better, one step at a time.
Are you doing a lot of guesswork?
Absolutely.
Alexis?
Yeah, definitely.
Wow. Let's talk about behavior. Alexis, what do you see in the behavior? What do children do when they grow up to be 13-year-olds? How do they act out?
Yeah, so they tend to lack impulse control. That's probably one of the main ones that I see. They can suffer from hyperactivity. A lot of them, you know, have co-occurring disorders and have ADHD as well. I see a lot of these kiddos getting taken advantage of by their peers. They'll kind of use them as a pawn, so to speak, like, hey, yeah, you want to go steal her purse? Do it for me, and then you can fit in and be part of the in crowd, you know, things like that. So they definitely are susceptible to victimization, easily agitated, anger outbursts, aggression. So, again, just, you know, lack of impulse control. And then, again, so that leads to what I mentioned earlier, adjudication. A lot of them end up on probation. I've had some on parole as well. So they're out there committing crimes. And, again, it could be a result of, hey, maybe they hook up with gang members or other kids who, you know, are stealing things, breaking the law. So they feed into negativity. They're pretty susceptible.
Austin, do you have any examples of that acting out on you, that they've, things that they've done with you as their adult?
Absolutely. I've been physically attacked more and more times than I can count. I've had about every bodily fluid thrown at me, and this is just, sometimes it's like Alexis has been saying, it's a hair trigger. There's zero impulse control, and sometimes when they're not understanding the world around them, they're, and I don't want to paint these children as horrible people. They're not. Some of them have been some of the best folks I've ever worked with, but they're impacted. And so they'll misunderstand something, or they're not quite getting what's going on. That is frightening. That's terrifying for them. And sometimes when you're that sole face of authority, when you're that first person in their life that is setting that structure, setting that boundaries, even though I was saying, yes, they need that, yes, they crave it, when you haven't had it, you fight it. We don't always just accept what we need in our lives, and so it's really taken the brunt of that. And what gets devastating is, you know, a lot of times we're working with them in controlled environments, like Alexis was touching on. Then they go back to an uncontrolled environment, and all this progress, everything is gone, sometimes in just a matter of moments, because without the control, without the impulse, and then the embarrassment, and they're still humans, and so when you're not understanding what's going on, of course you're going to learn to fake it, but that frustration tolerance isn't there, and a misunderstanding is a fight in the classroom, and you're booted out of school, you're on probation, and it's the...
Off down the road. You're off down the road.
With a drunk, a lot of times, where, you know, the prevalence of fighting or just that, without thinking, you're just completely angry and just doing things without thinking, it really could be compared to that.
Wow. Where do you start, Alexis? A child comes to you. Where do you start? How do you start to gain some kind of management control?
Well, I mean, we start with, you know, we'll do an assessment, kind of get a baseline, see where they're at. You usually check in with the kiddo and check in with the family and see what do they want to gain from their intervention at the treatment center. And so it's usually, you know, person-centered, family-driven. So they get a say in what they want to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty rare that they identify, their deficits, of course. And so a lot of times they'll maybe just say, hey, I'm tired of being angry all the time and losing self-control and, you know, punching things or whatever. And so it's kind of, it just depends on them. It's circumstantial. And so, and that is actually a pretty common one, though, learning to manage anger and learning to regulate their emotions. And so that's often the case. But a lot of times it's geared towards when you have the FAS kiddos, it's the family. The work is with the family. When you have a kiddo with FAS, again, we know that with those cognitive deficits and delays, they need what's called an external brain. They need somebody. They need their parent, primary caretaker, whoever it is, coming around them and doing the thinking for them. So that is setting up the day at home, very structured, having the rules very black and white at home. And so that really is what I've seen has been the most success, is when you can kind of format the structure of that child outside of care to where they have supports in place to help them be successful.
Alexis, you refer to them as kiddos, which seems to me to be a very affectionate term. So I'd like to ask you a personal question. Do you love these children?
I do. I do. And it's actually, you know, what I find the majority of the time with the kids that I work with is they don't have anybody that's in their corner that believes in them. It's very rare to find, like, a really strong family unit behind one of the kiddos who is admitted into my program. And so a lot of times just me building that relationship and that rapport and believing in them, they've never had that. They've never had that. And it goes such a long way, and it can be so effective.
Austin, you're a big, strong boy, man. What do you do with the incorrigibles?
Well, start with hope. You start at the same baseline. Everyone gets 100% of my belief they can do this. And what really drives me, especially in the therapeutic practice and now leading programs, setting cultures of the therapeutic that takes place, is it goes back to a psychiatrist named Viktor Frankl. He was a survivor. He came out of the Nazi death camps, and he survived. And he had the benefit of being a psychiatrist, and he was able to take a look. What is the difference between folks that went berserk and didn't make it and those folks that stayed strong and did make it? And it, to just completely oversimplify this very wise man, it kind of boils down to man can survive anyhow as long as there's a why. And so it's just really trying to break down, helping these children, what is your why? What is something bigger than you? Can we fold religion into this? Can it be even something as simple as, you know, making some healthy friends or finding just something outside of yourself? And for youth, I really do like to try to get them tied into something. Sports, band, art, it could be anything, but just take a moment to step outside of your current ecology, you know, whatever your influences in your life, because by the time you're working with us, you've made mistakes and they're there. So it's just stepping outside yourself, finding the why, and seeing what we can do. And we give them anything and everything we have, but we're not 100%. And with those youth, we don't have a solid answer for, and we're not helping. Especially, we can control behaviors, but there's a difference between controlling behaviors in a residential environment and improving and changing a life. Because the second you go back to that same environment without making some major changes, you're back wherever you go, there you are. And that's kind of the main thing, is how can we influence the environment? How can we influence and change the families that are working with them? And that's when we're successful. When we can change the culture of a family, when we can change how they're operating, we can change that individual life and everyone too.
Well, Alexis, where do you see hope? Because I haven't seen much of it in what you've said, but you must find it. Where do you find it?
You must. You must. And, you know, I think that the field has come a long way in the last 20 years or so. I know there's been lots of advances. you know, additional understanding of just what is going on with these mothers. And we now know that, this is chronic. And it's alcoholism, it's addiction, it's mental health. And so I think the hope is that we have a better understanding now, and we can take that next step to provide these women with the treatment and the prevention that is needed. So I think the hope is just, we've got to do more. We need to step up as a society, and we need to save these babies. And the way we save these babies is provide these services and interventions for the mothers.
Austin, we've, as a society, we've pretty much talked ourselves out of smoking cigarettes to the greater part. Would it not be possible to do a campaign in which we talked women, mothers, out of consuming alcohol and drugs when they're pregnant?
It sounds good in theory. My only suspicion about that is it's hard to believe that someone wouldn't know that it is bad for you. With, there is the public health statements out there, and that's where I really go back to. This is an addiction issue. And so when you're dealing with an addict, addiction is a culmination of a million little lies someone tells themselves. And that's how we end up with mothers who are otherwise great people making this horrendous choice to poison the child growing inside of them. And it's easy to stereotype, but these aren't strangers. These aren't the folks living on the bad end of town. These are our friends, our family, our coworkers. Addiction doesn't know demographics or anything, so a lot of it just boils down to recognizing that. I think public health campaigns are worth it, because this goes back.
Got to do something. Well, we're out of time.
We throw everything we can.
We're out of time here, but I thank you for breaking my heart tonight. Goodness sakes. But I'm happy that you are taking care of the children that weren't taken care of. Bless the both of you for the work that you do. Keep your chin up, and God bless you for the work. This has been The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour, with Austin and Alexis Olson. And you, thank you all for tuning in.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends miss the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.